CliffCentral.com. Good morning, everybody. Monday morning, CliffCentral.com, and we have lots of good stuff for you, including a bit of Collectomania coming up in a short while, some news we've got to get to, and lots more. So, are you feeling, and I don't want to jump the gun here, but are you feeling like we've been through the worst of winter? Because I'm optimistic that good times lie ahead. I watch a lot of these people who are on social media who are enjoying themselves in the summer of Europe and North America. I look at it and I go, must be nice. But then I think, oh, but wait, we've got our whole summer still ahead. Theirs is almost finished. Yes.
Yes. Yes, I was so jealous seeing some of my friends in Portugal. Oh. They went to the Afro Nation event, and I was so jealous watching all those posts. But it does feel like we're actually through the worst of winter. I was just saying last week to Simpiwe, walking out, that it's actually getting warmer.
I'm loving it.
It's actually getting warmer.
No. You don't have to persuade me. I'll believe any conspiracy theory that gets us there quicker. I'm all for it. Very, very exciting. Mm-hmm. So, a couple of things for this morning, and we'll start off with some of the things that Mash wanted to get to today. Obviously, we spoke a little bit about friend zoning earlier because Mash had this, what he thought was just a friend, touch his thigh at a very intimate little meeting, which wasn't meant to go that way, and Mash doesn't know how to now put this person back in the friend zone. But we've got other important things to get to, and this is quite scary. We talked not so long ago about how America has this gun problem, and obviously how there are all these mass shootings in America, but it seems that in South Africa we're now going in a similar direction. We saw about, you know, that story in the tavern in Soweto not so long ago. We also saw the story of these seven people who were killed in the farm and how they've arrested two people for that. But it seems to me like, you know, this is something we've got to, before we start pointing, because we were pointing our fingers at America when they had that most recent school shooting in Uvalde in Texas. We were like, hang on a second, you guys are doing something wrong. But a few days later, we have similar situations happening here in South Africa. What do you think's going on there? And do you think, because a lot of people like to simplify this and go, oh, it's just the guns. If we get rid of the guns, then we won't have a problem. But obviously that's not true. That would be a very silly and very childish way of looking at this, and certainly not going to solve any problems by looking at it that way, right?
Not at all. And the most terrifying thing about this is that it's become a weekly thing here in South Africa.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, every single weekend, there is a mass shooting, and there's no explanation for it. So that's the most terrifying thing. I like in America, when there's a mass shooting, guy gets caught, usually mental illness. This side, there is absolutely no explanation. And it's always at clubs. It's always at taverns. Mm-hmm. And it's just terrifying. So the fact that there's no explanation for this makes it so scary. I mean, I did see last week that there was another mass shooting just midday in Alexandra.
Yes.
And that's I actually really realized that we are in crisis mode. This is terrifying.
Yeah,
you can't even go to buy bread anymore without being scared of being shot, basically.
Well, are you? I mean, you also don't want to be paranoid, you know. Certainly there are reasons to be worried and there are reasons to be afraid, but you don't want to be paranoid and start thinking, oh, there are gunmen everywhere. I mean, look, we do live in a dangerous country. Let's not mess around.
Yes.
South Africa is one of those places where stuff like this does go down far more often than we would like it to, right? So you've got to be aware.
It does go down all
the... You've got to be aware, but South Africa is a violent place, full stop. Whereas, you know, you don't expect people to jump out of, an alleyway in America in every city and start shooting at you. Here in South Africa, we're used to crime. We've got so much of it going on. We've become kind of a little bit blasé about it in some ways.
And you can't help but think also, is it maybe something that's been happening all along?
Yeah.
It's just the media wasn't reporting on it.
Right.
Because I've heard many stories such as shootings at taverns and stuff like that, but then they never get to the news in the past. So it's just trying to figure out what exactly is going on is what's freaking me out at the moment.
It's almost as if you knew the problem was that there was this sniper on the loose or some jailbreakers who were dangerous. Or the fact that young girls between this age and this age are being targeted by this man who has a grudge against girls. You know, if you can pin the problem on something, then you can deal with it a bit better. But it's just all of these are senseless. There'd be no explanation.
There's no context. There's nothing.
Yeah.
And that is the most terrifying thing of it all for me.
I don't know if we're ever going to find an answer to this stuff. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Mash, that a lot of the time they find these people and then they discover that they're mentally ill. I think a lot of you could say every mass shooter has got to be mentally ill, right? I mean, that's the most logical explanation for that kind of behavior. Why else would someone do those kinds of things? Why would they behave like that? Why would they do something that's completely pathological and sociopathic? It doesn't make sense otherwise.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we've also got to look at how much, and this is where it does help to have like a little bit of a view of history, because humans, we tend to think that the default position is peace, and that the default situation for humanity is that we all get along and everybody's kind of friendly and, you know, you don't go into a place with a desire to cause conflict or any of that stuff. And, you know, war is like something that happened in our distant past. But actually, for thousands and thousands of years, the opposite has been true. Humans are quite violent. Humans are quite territorial. Humans are jealous and greedy, and they are motivated by emotion. And all of that stuff leads to an explanation which maybe we don't want to face up to, which is that humans are actually quite shit. And we're not very nice to each other, and we will resort to violence more often than we think we will, because we're not as good as we think we are. That's worth considering. It's worth thinking about, even if it's not pleasant to think about it, right?
I think especially in, you know, because some of the cases, it's not a lone gunman. In those cases, one could easily accept or acknowledge a mental health issue. But when there are three or four gunmen together doing this, it makes me think it's either robbery, and in some cases the patrons haven't been robbed, or it must be territorial. What makes me think.
Well,
yeah.
Lucky says most of these shootings are gang-related, and it's just the media that are starting to report on it now, but it's been going on for years. Well, that's the other thing that nobody wants to say, is that when these things happen in like a I suppose if it happens to wealthier, more connected, more influential people, then it immediately hits the news. When it's just poor people in a poor neighborhood, there's less interest in it, right? That's always the truth. It always has been, always will be. It's not necessarily right or fair, but that's just how it works. That's how the media take an interest in something. There was a shooting, says Sebastian, about a month ago at a bar where my colleague's son died. They have video footage and number plates, and he's apparently not hard to find, yet no arrest. See, that's probably one that we didn't even know about. I know it's the age-old statement. This is from Derek. But often the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, that's true. I mean, that's why we arm our policemen, for example. Which Cape Town are you guys talking about that is freezing? I'm in shorts and a T-shirt. Oh, nice, Sanele. Oh, nice. Very nice. Shorts and a T-shirt. Then we really are starting to move towards spring. I'm not going to count our chickens. I don't want to, like, because there's always some really cold snap that happens before spring. But let's be honest also, this has not been the coldest winter. And I'm touching wood the whole time while I'm saying this, not because I'm superstitious, but because I really hate the cold. It hasn't been the worst winter ever. We haven't frozen our titties off like we have before. And although there were reports of snow hitting Gauteng and all of that stuff, I don't think it ever happened. So we really don't have much to moan about when it comes to this winter, do we? Don't think so.
No, I'm just keeping not quiet on this one. Someone
thinks anything. Never true that it's freezing. I'm in the southern suburbs. Oh, that's also in Cape Town. So lots of people there. But Sanele says, this morning I'm having tea and an orange slice instead of coffee to see how miserable I would be in a relationship where I was lying about who I am. Whew. Some real honest truth coming out there. All right, let's talk about this, because this is a good story. This is something that will make you feel happy this morning. There's a new miracle drug that they're working on, which may increase human lifespan to 200 years. Now, I'm going to say this up front. A lot of people do not want to live to 200 years. A lot of people say, well, we don't want that. 100 years is plenty. You don't want to be a 200. How do we know what a 200-year-old man or woman is going to look like? They'd probably be terrifying.
Yes.
But
my first train of thought on this is if you get to live to 200, but you stop aging at, let's say, 35.
Oh, no, then physically. It's great. Then it's terrific. Then we're all
then
in,
it's
right?
Great.
I mean, I'm in anyway. I don't care what I look like because by 200, I'm going to be so wise and I'll be so full of life experience. I mean, I might be crumbling. I might be dust piled on dust. I mean, who knows what I'll look like, but I'm up for it. And I know lots of people don't want to, but if you don't want to, then don't. Don't take the drug. But if I can and I can live to 200, I will.
Well, this all came about from a British computational biologist who recently published a new book on the longevity of human life. He argues that, and he is a doctor as well, that it's completely feasible for humans to live beyond our standard 100-year lifespan to a new type of drug. He says that this new field of research is known as senolytics.
Right.
And it could give birth to a miracle drug capable of increasing the human lifespan. And I mean, whether or not I believe
so what you're telling me is that there isn't a drug yet, but that he says it's possible we could develop one. Ugh. I thought we already had one. Sorry. Got excited for nothing.
Exactly. And that, well, it's the trial is ongoing at the moment.
Yeah.
In fact, back in 2020, where they used it on mice, it showed exceptional results, improving physical function and extending lifespan and health. And so this is the idea. But, you know, then the exact argument you guys brought up was, can humans live for too long?
Yeah.
You know, what is the quality of life going to be from the age of 101 to 200, you know? I really, if it's going to be what I expect, then I'm not into it, you know?
You wouldn't go for it?
Not if I'm going to feel like a 101-year-old for the rest of my life.
I'll take my chances, hey? I mean, you can always decide. Yeah, you always decide, look, I'm going to stop doing the drug, I suppose, and then you can just quietly go off into the sunset. You see, you can always end. This is the point. You could always end your life. You could always say, well, I've had enough. But you can't always extend your life. So again, it's like the argument we were having just now about guns. It's better to have a gun and not need one than to need a gun and not have one. It's better to be able to live to 200 and not want to than to wish you could live to 200 and not be able to.
My only concern about this whole thing is just quality of life. I do not want to be a straw. I don't want to have a pipe going in my mouth and a pipe going out. And that's how I live for the rest of my life. That's my worst nightmare.
Right. Well, I mean, let them carry on. Let them perfect this. Hopefully somewhere in our lifetimes we get to a point where we can actually just take a pill. Live to 200. And, in fact, it would be even better, Mash, if you could determine your age that you would like to physically be. In other words, you can take drugs and you can get yourself, let's say you start taking them at 40 and you can stay 40 for, you know, 100 years. That would be worth it.
Yes. Life will be like the Vampire Diaries.
Damn.
Everybody just looks 40, but we're like 300 years old, 200 years old. That'll be fun.
I would like that. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all.
It's true. I mean, I think it might be happening naturally anyway, because how often do we hear the record of the oldest person living?
Yeah.
That it's been broken again.
Yeah.
In our lifetimes, we've heard that a million times. Somewhere something is working.
Asher points out, and this is a podcast we actually promoted on Cliff Central. We did it with them for a while. They called it the 200-year-old. And that was a fascinating discussion because it was basically around the fact that there is a person alive somewhere in the world today who will live to 200. That person is already among us. And if you think about it, by looking after yourself, by doing exercise, by eating right, by, you know, feeding your brain with all the things that you need to be fed, with making sure that you live with some kind of purpose and some long-term vision, you could get to 200 if you were, you know, born in the right place at the right time into the right family. It's all about resources. It's also about genes. But there could be drugs that help us along the way. And that would be a bloody amazing thing. I still don't understand.
I mean, for some of us, it feels too late already. You know, being born in the 70s or 80s, if you think about how much tartrazine and carcinogenic stuff we consumed without even knowing it, how much exposure to sun we had with just two little zinc stripes on our cheeks, you know, it feels like it's a bit late. I think the person who's going to live to 200 must be only being born now or like 2 or 3 years old.
I don't know. Probably. I mean, maybe it is too late for us. I'm not giving up. If this drug can really be made effective quickly and if it can be put on the market fast, there will obviously be errors and mistakes. And we all know, you know, people are suspicious of drugs that are made very quickly. Like the vaccine, for example, we still have all these anti-vaxxers and people who are suspicious that the vaccine is doing things that it shouldn't do to your body. But I'm willing to take the chance with a 200-year-old, you know, life in front of me. I mean, that would be amazing. I'd be so down for that. I don't see any downside. I don't see any, like, you know, a year of extra life, even a year of extra life. How many people would give up something in their world right now for an extra year of life? Would you give up coffee? Would you sell something that you really care about? Would you sell a phone to have an extra year of life? I bet you when the Grim Reaper comes knocking, you'll say, "Here's my phone. I'll have another year. Thank you very much."
Take my cat. Mm-hmm.
Jackson says, "We would want to make it 350. Lol, it's been our favorite number for a while. 350 years old, according to Jackson. All right, well, that's quite a lot. Sanele says, am I the only one who wants to go early? I honestly have no interest in living a day beyond 70. I'm good with anything between 60 and 70. I want to die with a six-pack and still good-looking. Well, I don't even have a six-pack now, so I doubt I'll have that at 60. But yes, I hear you.
I think the type of person who wants to live.
I don't want to look too old in my coffin. Well, who cares what you look like in your coffin? Really?
Yeah, I think the type of person who wants to live to 200 is probably not worried about what their body looks like. They're more worried about things that they can see in their lifetime and experience and research and bear witness to.
I think Earth is so fascinating, and living here as a human being on this planet at this time is just the best thing. We're seeing so many changes happen in real time. Before change happened a lot more slowly. You know, they invented something, some far flung corner of Asia, and it took like 100 years for everyone to learn about it. A volcano exploded somewhere, and it took you 20 years to hear about that volcano that exploded in the South Pacific because you lived in, I don't know, North America. These days, we find out about everything like this, and it's all so quick, and you have access to information like never before. And what a fascinating time to be alive. You know, I think this is an incredible thing to actually exist at this time and to be able to experience all the things that humanity is going through. We may just make breakthroughs in the course of our lifetimes, like a 200-year-old pill, or like going to Mars, or like, you know, orbiting the solar system. Who knows what's possible?
Yeah. I always say, I always say, I find it so fascinating, especially in terms of my parents, because my parents are in their mid to late 40s. And I find it so fascinating how they lived through so many, like, they basically lived through the birth of things. Yeah. And I find that to be so fascinating because, guys, think about it. The laptops you guys are staring at right now didn't exist when you guys were kids.
Are you kidding?
The TVs that you guys watch. In fact, TVs didn't exist at all when you guys were kids.
Not in this country. No, they didn't.
Fascinating.
You're right.
Living through all of that. And, I mean, I feel so unfortunate sometimes because I never actually got to live through a time period where none of this stuff existed. I was born, there was laptops, there was TVs. Yeah. And I just wish I could have lived through that. I really do. That's why I'm willing to actually take the pill and live for the next 200 to 350 years.
See what happens,
Just so I can also witness the next revolution or evolution of technology and just the world in general.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. All right, so a couple of things we need to get to before Collectomania. This is pretty amazing. Apparently, Skittles are unsafe for consumers. Skittles, you know, like the those little candy-covered things that you get, multicolored chewy sweets that you get in a packet. There is a lawsuit in America. Apparently, they've taken the Skittles people to court, and they've decided that they are unfit for human consumption because they contain a known toxin. Now, I'm sure that most of the food that we've been eating, and you mentioned it just now, Leanne, like tartrazine and, you know, monosodium glutamate and that kind of thing. These things are all over our food. And I'm sure that a lot of the stuff we eat, you know, if you braai a chop for too long and it's a little, like, blackened on the fat part of it, which is always so nice to eat. But that's obviously carcinogenic. There are lots of things that we eat, that we ingest, that we drink, that we smoke, that are bad for us. So why would Skittles be singled out here for being known as a dangerous thing to eat and having a known toxin in them? What's that all about?
Well, it's because it was discovered quite a while ago. I think it was in 2016 that they were called out. And let's remember that it's the Mars Group who owns Skittles. They were called out already for this known toxin. And they said they would do something about it, but they never did.
Yeah.
So that was in – it's basically Mars uses titanium dioxide.
Jesus.
To produce Skittles' well-known array of artificial colors.
Right.
I was hoping you might be able to shed some light on that.
Well, the only thing I know about titanium dioxide is that it is used in it's used in art paints anyway. It's a white powder. I don't know that it's a particularly dangerous thing for humans. I don't think titanium is really an element or a mineral that we even use in our bodies. So I would expect that our bodies would just pass it through. You know, you wouldn't have a use for titanium in your body, unless, of course, they make a titanium artificial limb for you or something like that. You know, titanium is quite useful to repair things, and it's strong as hell. But it doesn't have – and titanium dioxide is just useful in pigments because it makes them brighter, and it allows for that sort of matte finish in paints. It's always been a useful pigment. It's, as I said, white. But I don't know anything really dangerous about titanium dioxide. What do they say is so dangerous about it?
So they're saying that the quantity of titanium dioxide should not exceed 1% of the food's weight.
Yeah.
And apparently in this case, it exceeds that. They're saying that the problem is down the line. So after oral ingestion, the absorption of titanium dioxide particles is low. However, they do accumulate in the body. And apparently that, over time, messes with your genotoxicity, which is, you know,
what that means.
Now starting to come to damage the chemicals which form genetic information, like DNA.
Okay, well, maybe there is something going on there. Hey, listen, I think a lot of stuff is poisonous for us. Like I said just now, it's probably stuff that we eat and drink and smoke and carry on with every day that's awful for us. Something's going to kill you. That's why we need these 200-year-old pills immediately. Then we can carry on drinking and eating the things we want, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about titanium dioxide. Sure. Also, I mean, I don't even like Skittles that much, so I think I'll manage without that. All right, so it's time for Collectomania.
I don't know anyone who does.
No, yeah. Exactly. It's time for Collectomania, which, of course, is brought to you by the South African Gold Coin Exchange and the Scoin Shop. You can check them out at scoinshop.com. We don't need any more collectors because we're actually taking a break with Collectomania. We are putting it on hold for a little while. But for Mandela Day, we thought we'd look at a very special collection. We're going to speak to someone at the archive at the Center of Memory, which is a space where the legacy of Nelson Mandela is preserved. If you've ever been to the Nelson Mandela Foundation, the Center of Memory is open to the public. I have watched, you know, I've been through it. I've looked at it. You can actually see his office that Madiba used to work in, which has been kept exactly as it was when he used to work there. There are lots of things that you can see, too. And we'll talk to somebody from that department at the Nelson Mandela Foundation. Her name is Razia Saleh. We'll speak to her in just a short while. Talk about the collection. What's in it? Can you imagine the value of some of those things? Because it's an incredible collection. And today, of course, is Mandela Day. So what more appropriate thing could we do than this? And Collectomania is, of course, brought to you by the guys at the South African Gold Coin Exchange, Rail, who we spoke to just the other day. You can find out more from them by going along to their offices and speaking to them. So we'll get to that in a moment or two with Razia. I'm very excited to hear about that. Have you guys, like, is there something going on for Mandela Day today? Are people doing something? Have I not been paying attention? Does anyone know? Mash, Leanne, do you guys know what's going on?
I don't know. Isn't it the day that we're meant to dedicate a certain amount of time to
service,
doing something good?
Yeah,
67 minutes.
Right, and
yes.
I mean, that can't be very difficult.
But no, it crept up on me. I mentioned it to my brother last night. I said, oh, tomorrow's Nelson Mandela Day. So I certainly haven't seen anything that grabbed my attention before that.
Mm. On my side, so I do quite a bit of content planning and stuff like that. I'm quite into social media, so I did know it's coming up, and I did actually plan quite a number of activities for today where I will just be basically... Okay, oh, it might sound a bit terrible, but
go on.
Just going out and about, giving out food, you know, taking pictures.
Taking pictures?
Yeah, that's about it.
What, do you take,
pictures.
You take pictures to show how hungry the people were before you gave them the food?
Gareth.
I don't know.
Gareth, you'll be pleased to know that, you'll be pleased to know that actually everything is under control because Nelson Mandela International Day is being... marked by a very important person, especially to you, I know.
Yeah, who?
And that's Prince Harry. He will give a UN keynote speech today.
Oh.
So all good.
Oh, I'm so excited about that, Prince Harry. He's always got so much interesting stuff to say, doesn't he? I wonder if Meghan's written his speech for him. She said, I'll give you your balls back for like 5 minutes if I can write your speech. Sure, darling, anything you want, darling, no problem at all, darling, sure. Pathetic.
Sure.
So, do you guys think that the Forever Young drug, says Ethan, that you guys mentioned will include taurine? Taurine is slowly becoming my new favorite drug and I want it in everything. Isn't that the stuff they have in energy drinks, Ethan?
Oh, I love it.
You like energy drinks?
I love energy drinks, and when they have taurine, they just make me even feel better. I know it's bad for you. I don't know how it's bad for you though.
Yeah. I'm sure that anything like caffeine is supposedly bad for you too. So anything that ends in "ine" is like a certain kind of chemical, and they keep discovering new ones. Because if you look at these energy drinks, they always say with added taurine or with added. There was one that I saw yesterday that was given to me free. I bought some other stuff, and they gave me this as like a sample. And I looked at it, and I was like, hang on a second. I've never heard of this chemical before, and I'm not an expert on organic chemistry, so I wouldn't have known anyway. But it seems to me they're discovering new ones all the time. So I'm kind of confused as to what these things do to you. But supposedly, according to some people, it energizes the nervous system, all right? Energy drinks equals sugar equals fat, says Tabo. He's not a fan. Codeine is the best of the eens. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what are those? Aren't the various – oh, no, those are canes. The lidocaine, novocaine, cocaine. Those are the family of – okay, I was thinking of those. But codeine, yeah, codeine's also – I suppose, you know, not something...
Codeine is also pretty terrible. I've never heard anybody die from energy drinks, but I've heard of people dying from codeine.
How much energy drink is good for you, though? Because if you get too much stimulant in you, that's also a very bad thing for your system. We all know this. Mm. I mean, we've seen people who are overstimulated in caffeine, especially if you're young and you take too much of that stuff. It does mess with your rhythms.
Mm. Yeah,
I used to work in quite a... super, super high stakes, high pressure environment. And to get by, I actually used to take caffeine tablets that you get at a pharmacy. And they're called caffeine kick or something. I used to take those every single day. And in the morning, I'd take pre-workout because I'd go to gym. Then in the evening, I'd also have an energy drink because I'd have to keep working throughout the evening as well. So I remember there was a day, I kept doing this every single day. It was my usual cycle.
Must have knocked you
and
for a stick.
There was a day where I actually kept twitching. I was like literally twitching and having little mini speeches. I'll start talking to someone like, hi, how are you? It was
you are not going to be that person among us who lives to 200.
200, not a chance. All right, it is time for us to apply our minds to Collectomania. We love talking to people about their collections, and we've spoken to a lot of people over the last few months about their personal collections. Now, the person we're going to speak to today is someone who actually manages a very important collection that is of paramount importance to us as South Africans, because it has to do with our first democratically elected president, and someone who we still revere and hold in high regard. Today is Mandela Day, and that's the man we're talking about, Nelson Mandela. I'm pleased to welcome to the show Razia Saleh, who's here with us this morning. Hey, Razia, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks.
Good. Razia, thank you so much for waking up so early and going in this morning to talk to us, because we've got so much to talk to you about. And, of course, it's a spectacular and auspicious day today, being Mandela Day, for us to talk about the actual collection in the Center of Memory, which I remember I was there for the opening of the Center of Memory when it was opened by then-President Jacob Zuma. And it was a moment for us to take in. I remember walking around, seeing some of the exhibits there. You guys have got an enormous number of very valuable documents, of incredible artifacts and things that we'll all talk about in a moment or two. But it must be a huge responsibility for you to take care of all of this stuff in the Center of Memory.
Yes, it is. I do feel sometimes overwhelmed by the responsibility of looking after the material, but we've set all the systems in place. We've got an archival repository that was refurbished when we did the opening in 2013, in November of 2013, the occasion that you are referring to. So we're quite confident that if we do everything properly, we'll be able to preserve Madiba's legacy in the physical sense for the future generations.
Well, it is a spectacular thing to see, and it is open to the public. You've just got to make sure that you make an appointment, right? I mean, people can come and see the actual office where Madiba used to work.
Yes, so we ask people to make an appointment, just because we are not only an archival repository, but a working institution, and we may have occasions where the access to the building is a bit difficult because we've got an event on or visiting dignity or something like that. But our exhibition on Madiba, his life and time, includes his post-presidential office, which he used from 2002 until he last came to the office in 2010.
So just tell us about that office, because it's quite something to see. I mean, it's been preserved as it was when he used to come into the office. It's got the same books on the shelves that he would have referred to. It's got a little area where famous people from all over the world would come to meet Madiba and sit down and have tea with him. His desk is exactly in the same place that it was. I mean, this was a working office at the time, right?
Yes. So Madiba established the Nelson Mandela Foundation in 1999 when he stood down as president of the country. The foundation for the first 3 years operated from his house in Houghton, which is now Century Mandela Boutique Hotel. And in 2002, the house became small for the foundation, so they moved to the current premises where we are situated, and that was Madiba's post-presidential office, where he held, you know, in the first few years until 2002, he actually came into the office almost daily and had a long working day, and he would meet all sorts of people in the office. So we've kept the actual office as it is, as the photo here is showing, exactly like how he used it the last time he was here in 2010.
Amazing. It must be a very evocative place. I'm sure that people from all over the world still come to just be there because it maintains some kind of presence. And you think about all the important discussions that must have taken place there. It's a place that's very powerful, right?
Yes. Yes, it's absolutely powerful. When he passed away in 2013, we had just really, we had opened the facilities a month before.
Mm.
But in that 10 days of mourning, we had, you know, we were open throughout the day, over the weekend, and we had people just coming in, and people would go into the office and they would just cry, because, you know, it's not a very fancy office, but you can actually feel Madiba's presence there. And even now, when we get requests from heads of state and visiting dignitaries and celebrities to come and visit the foundation,
yes,
they do go into the office, and I think it holds a very special place in most people's heart.
So Razia, I mean, you have to manage so many different documents and so many artifacts and so many important things from the Nelson Mandela Foundation's Center of Memory. There must be many things that we don't see that are locked up in safes that that you probably are still making your way through, because there must be a ton of documents. You know, any life as illustrious as Madiba's, there must be so many things, and people must be contributing to the archives. New things are discovered all the time. Things from Madiba's very distant past, when he was a lawyer, things from when he was a student, things from when he was in jail. There are obviously lots and lots of papers and documents. Do you guys have sufficient storage space, and do you have to keep these things in safes? What kind of stuff is in the archives?
Well, we say that the Mandela Archive is vast and scattered all over the world, so we don't keep everything at the foundation. We've taken a policy decision when the Center of Memory was established in 2004 not to bring everything under one roof.
Uh-huh.
So we have we have a record of where different things are. So, for instance, Madiba's archive that the Department of Correctional Services created when he was incarcerated is with the National Archive. His archive as deputy president and then president of the ANC is with the ANC archive at the University of Fort Hare. And then various other things, his various trials, their archives, the archives of the trial are at various different places. So at Wits University, the University of Cape Town in the Special Collections Department, mm-hmm. at the National Archives of South Africa, we have some material as well. So it's all over, and it's for there's various good reasons why they are in those different spaces. And we've taken a policy decision to leave them where they are. But what we think is a small collection have found its way through to us. So we do have a physical collection, and some of those images that you showed just now,
yes,
depict that. Yes, so we have, we call it the Nelson Mandela Gifts Collection and the Awards Collection. So over the years, Madiba received many gifts, and that's an example of a soccer t-shirt signed by Pelé, the famous legendary soccer player. And in the corner there, you see those cream boxes. Those are Madiba's private papers. So when he left Victor Verster prison on the 11th of February 1990, in the boot, he had many cartons of his artifacts that he left prison with. Hmm. And some of those he's deposited with us. And we think they are quite precious. So from 1976, Madiba had something called a death calendar. It was produced by South African Tourism. And then Madiba started using it as a diary in which he noted all sorts of interesting and fascinating things that he found in the course of his incarceration, you know. So if he read a book or he watched a movie in the later years, there's a note of his blood pressure when he became ill. He was, you know, they were monitoring his health.
Yes.
So he would notice blood pressure three times a day. And then when he moved to Victor Verster prison, he was not in a cell, in a jail that consisted of a cell.
Yes.
He was in an ex-warden house. And the conditions of his jail had changed considerably. So he was allowed visitors every day, and they could stay as long as he wanted. And his warder was someone called Jack Swart, mm-hmm. was also his chef. And Jack Swart would cook for Madiba three times a day, for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner. And whoever visited Madiba would join in any of those meals when they were there. So we have, the death calendar has a record. You know, he would say on so such and such a day, Mam Winnie visited, or his daughter visited, or some delegation from the United Democratic Front, or the trade unions,
right,
or his lawyers visited him, and it's all noted in the diary, which makes fascinating reading.
So that's in those boxes behind in this picture where Sello is busy looking at the Pele shirt. Sello, of course, the CEO of the Nelson Mandela Foundation. But these boxes seems like an enormous amount of paperwork. I mean, we've all, you know, in our lives generated a lot of stuff, but Madiba was also very prolific. He used to write letters, he used to write speeches, he used to, in his own hand, compile many, many documents, and obviously would keep track of these things.
Yes, so Madiba was a prolific writer. Even his post-prison notes, I think we have about 8 to 10 of those clean boxes.
Yes.
On all sorts of notebooks, pieces of paper, various, you know, post-it notes. So he would, when he attended meetings, he would actually verbatim take down what people are saying. And we think that focused his mind and allowed him to engage with whatever the topic was that was being discussed. So often you'd see in his notebooks, Thabo Mbeki said whatever Thabo Mbeki said in the meeting, or Tara Lakota, Cheryl Carolus, Trevor Manuel, whoever was in the meeting, he would note what they would say on the issue that was being discussed. And I think that allowed him to focus concentrate and then come up with his own arguments. So he never lip serviced.
These notes must be these must be so useful to historians. I mean, you must be inundated with requests from people to come in and view these letters, these archives, to be able to access this information when they're writing books about the history of South Africa, when they're trying to piece together what happened post-1994 in the establishment of the new government. I mean, all of this is extremely valuable information.
Yes, so we've digitized, I think, all of Madiba's papers. So we do have a bit of a backlog as new material come in. We digitize it as it comes in. But his private personal papers, his notes, his notebooks, they've all been digitized. And we launched our archive portal, a revamped archive portal earlier this year. So you can actually do online searches looking for information. So a lot of the visit these days in the digital age is via email, and then we, you know, send low-res copies of the information. But we do get requests by documentary filmmakers. And next year is going to be the 10th anniversary of Madiba's passing, and we've already had about 4 or 5 media houses preparing for the occasions.
Absolutely.
Next year, who are starting to use some of this material. And we've also had, you know, academics coming and wanting access to various aspects of Madiba's archive.
I'm going to get Mash and Leanne to ask you a couple of questions too, because I'm sure they have lots. But here is a tour of Sello showing somebody here the archives with the awards. And Madiba received many awards from governments, from NGOs, from organizations, from business over the years. And storing these, some of them quite valuable, I would imagine, you know, medals, coins, all kinds of things that were struck in his honor. This must be an important thing to also keep a record of, right?
Yes, so we've catalogued each and every item that Madiba received in his gift collection and his awards collection, but we don't have, I think we just have a fraction of what there is. The bulk of the gifts and awards are with the state at the Nelson Mandela Museum in Mthatha, and then there's also various materials at the various different Mandela charities and at his various homes. And some of it is very precious. We have the Nobel Peace Prize, the medallion, and the certificate that goes with it. We've got a safe where we keep those kind of things in a safe, just so we can look after it properly and rest assured that it won't get stolen. And very few people at the foundation and have the combination to the safe. So we're able to track who opens the safe. Hmm. And we also have CCTV in the vault. So we think wow. we've got it reasonably secure.
That's amazing. Mash, Leanne, you've got a few things that you wanted to ask Razia?
Yes, Razia. Wow, I'm so amazed by this entire collection. And you did mention that the security is very high. But speaking as a member of the public, what if I do actually want to come see the collection? Do you guys offer that privilege to the public?
Well, the archive vault, we prefer the public to visit our exhibition upstairs and to visit Madiba's post-presidential office. But we do allow visits on special occasions to the vault. It's guided, so you wouldn't be allowed to walk around there freely without any supervision from one of the archive staff.
And you do.
So it's huge. You need to make the booking.
And you regularly change the exhibition upstairs as well. So you show off many different items from the vault in the exhibition, correct?
We have two exhibition spaces. So the one is a permanent exhibition on the life and times of Madiba. And that's pretty static, but we do refresh it every now and then, adding additional elements to it. Then we have a temporary exhibition space there. Could be on anything, contemporary social issues or past struggle heroes. So one of the things Madiba always said to us, and he's always maintained that he wasn't alone in the struggle against apartheid. He was part of a collective, and that we shouldn't just focus on him. We should focus on many other people. So our current temporary exhibition is on Walter Sisulu, and it's called Reality Check. The Rivonia trial that happened, the trial that sent Madiba and various other people to jail for life, the recording of the trial was done something on called Dictabels, the old, almost looks like a vinyl LP, the recording mechanism. And for many years, the playback machine for the Dictabels was non-existent. So nobody actually could access the recordings on the Dictabel. And then a few years ago, the National Archives went into partnership with the French Institute for Audiovisual Archives, and they had actually developed a machine that could play the dictabells, and then those dictabells were digitized. So the Reality Check Walter Sisulu exhibition takes the recording with Sisulu speaking in court, and has created this beautiful exhibition. So there's 14 or 15 minutes of the actual dictabel recordings that have been digitized that you can hear. You can hear Sisulu, you can hear Judge Quarters, the vet, you can hear Advocate Bram Fisher, and Percy Yuta. And there's been, and to supplement the recording, there's a line art drawing that, you know, reflects the Palace of Justice. So you put on these virtual reality goggles and you actually feel you're sitting in 1964 in the courthouse listening to the voices and watching the footage. It's quite amazing.
Wow.
So we have a temporary exhibition and a permanent exhibition, and we do take out objects from the artifacts for display for, you know, important milestones, special occasions of visiting dignitaries as well.
Razia, just the other day there was a news story about the boxing belt, Sugar Ray Leonard boxing belt that was stolen from the house in Soweto. This is obviously sad, and especially for people like you who are interested in preserving the history and the archives. It must be very annoying and irritating and sad for us to realize that there are going to be people who will try to get hold of these things. You mentioned security earlier. But has the archive also not got plenty of new stuff? Because ordinary people may want to donate to the archive when they have a personal relationship, or they'd received something from Madiba, or their letters. You must obviously take in new things all the time too, right?
Yes, we do get new things in. So in terms of Madiba, we've looked high and low for photos of a young Madiba.
Mm-hmm.
But the earliest we have is from 1938, 1939. So we're hoping that somebody out there still would have a younger Madiba. He attended K.D. Matanziwa's funeral, sorry, my apologies, his wedding.
Yes.
And we suspect there would have been photos of, you know, of Madiba at the wedding as a youngster. And we've contacted the family, but we haven't found those. But most of the stuff that's coming in is post-1990. So we had somebody who worked in Parliament who contacted us a few months ago, who had the menu and a few things from the visit of the Queen of England, Elizabeth II, Her Royal Highness. And she donated the menu and the invitation card to us. So we do get every now and then somebody or the other finding an artifact or an object, and then they donate it to us. But we're still looking for some of the earlier things. But, you know, Madiba grew up in quite a rural area, and although modernity had reached the area, but it wasn't, you know, cameras and photographs.
Sure.
And that kind of thing wasn't very easily available. It's not like the cell phone today where you get dime a dozen photographs of things. So we're still looking, hoping we'd find photos of a young Madiba.
There's an incredible, rich history of South Africa in all of these objects. It just pleases me no end that there are places like the Center of Memory that are keeping the mm-hmm. legacy of Madiba alive. It's very, very special and so important, Razia.
Yes, we think, you know, Madiba had, he sacrificed his entire life for the struggle. And even after his death, he has a lot that we can all learn from in a post-Madiba world, which is, you know, this conflict and xenophobia and racism that's still systemic and endemic all over the world. And Madiba, we often get asked the question, how come he wasn't bitter? You know, he spent 27 and a half years of his life in jail at a time when he was in the prime. He went to jail when he was 44 years old, and he came out when he was 71 years old. So it's a long, long, long period of sacrifice. How come he wasn't bitter? But Madiba always found the good in people. He always trusted people until he's proven or they've proven otherwise. And we think those are valuable lessons that people can live in a world that seems so divided and so fractured, and there's so much poverty and inequality and racism. So we think that it's very important to preserve, not just to preserve it, but to use his legacy in a way that promotes a better world.
Well, it's so important that you're doing the job that you're doing, and we're very grateful to you for making time for us this morning. I know that you must have a very busy day ahead. Nelson Mandela Day today, all across the world, International Day, where we all celebrate our bit of service, our 67 minutes. But in your case, Razia, it's also a lifetime of making sure that all these incredible documents and this incredible archive are available and kept safe and pristine for the use of so many more generations into the future, who will continue to be inspired and want to reflect on the life of Nelson Mandela. It's a great pleasure to have you on our show. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Nice to see you, Razia. Thank you. And love to everybody at the foundation.
Will do.
Thank you. There's Razia Saleh, who is at the Nelson Mandela Foundation Center of Memory. And you can actually go and see some of that stuff. Isn't that cool?
Oh, it's so amazing. Really, it makes our jobs just seem so insignificant compared to what she's sitting there doing. But all I can imagine is, I mean, there have been people in the past, pre-Madiba, in history, long time ago, who probably thought, you know, this, in a world without digital, how on earth are we going to preserve this stuff?
Yep.
And it all became about the physical preservation. What a relief it must have been when digital storage became available. I'm sure that some people slept better at night, knowing that there was at least a photograph or a scan of something in the cloud.
Well, I mean, there are these companies now that actually will take your old family photos and things from a long time ago and preserve them digitally. And these companies are really incredible. They take everything, they scan them, they do high-resolution versions of things. They take old video cassette tapes, the kind that we were talking about on Friday, Leanne, and they turn them into digital recordings. And it's so important. I mean, even if you think it's not, even if you think, oh, please, my family aren't famous or important. I'm not important. I'm not famous. Someone somewhere along the way may want those documents one day, and it's best that you try to find a way to preserve them, especially if it matters, even if it's just to you. You know, this is your story. And maybe one day, if you have kids or grandkids or great-grandkids, they're going to want to look back and learn about the life that you lived. It's a great reason to keep an eye on these things.
Mm. It'd even be worth digitally printing some of the stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Just that you have some kind of replica that's in 3D form.
Sure. And who knows? I mean, this is why we do Collectomania. You know, the things that you don't think are particularly important, someone else is just desperate for, and they will pay any amount of money or spend any amount of time trying to collect those things. So look after what you've got, and if there's any lesson we can take from Collectomania today, it is that while you might not be Nelson Mandela, you should be looking after the stuff. And I always think it's a great day to reflect, if nothing else. You may not be doing 67 minutes. Maybe you're not that kind of person. I know that you are, Mash, and I'm very pleased to hear that you're doing something. It's just a good day to reflect also on what kind of a history we have in this country, because we don't bother to look back nearly enough. And when we do look back, it's only at the things that we especially want to focus on that are important to us personally. But this country has been through a hell of a time. And over the last 50 to 100 years, this man has played such an important role. Do not let the revisionist historians of 2022 take away any of the incredible work, impact, inspiration, trouble that was gone to by those leaders of the early 90s who made South Africa what it currently is, who wrote our constitution, who did so much to make this country a free and open society. And I know we tend to look at the most recent past and we think of all the corruption and the stupidity and the bad governance and Eskom and the petrol price, but there was a time when these people who made South Africa had a vision for what we could be, and we should look back on that. We should look back on that and be proud of where we've come from. We've got a tremendous amount to be very, very enthusiastic about in South Africa, even now. And it's easy for you to fall into the trap of like, oh, well, it's all that's in the past, and now it's a disaster. That's not going to get you anywhere. It's important to acknowledge and respect the history that we have. And, you know, I'm a fan of history. I'm a student of history. I love this stuff more than you probably should. But it's important that we live in a world where we can take stock of how far we've come. And Nelson Mandela is an important part of that story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so is Gedleyihlekisa and Thabo Mbeki. I mean, can you imagine going through those? imagine going through those diaries and seeing what Madiba had to say about all of these other people. I think it must be fascinating. All right, it's been so fun. Mash Ass, thank you very much for the Mash and Ass show this morning. And we will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. bright and early. Have an excellent Nelson Mandela Day and be good. Check you out later. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Cliff Central. Dot com.